Welcome to the Fundamental Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Paul Saladino. This podcast is the result of my relentless search to understand and correct the roots of chronic disease and illness. In this podcast, I will share with you everything I have learned about how to live the most healthy and radical life possible. Thanks for joining me on this journey. What is up, you guys? Hello, hello. It is good to be with you today. Welcome to Fundamental Health This Week. I think you're going to dig this one. This is an episode with Kevin Stock. He is a pretty radical dude. As you know, I love the word radical, but in this case, highly appropriate. He is a strict carnivore. He is a dentist. He's passionate about health and fitness and has been so for two decades. He's the founder and CEO of Muscle Science. He's a previous national level physique competitor. He's a dentist, like I said, so he's a smart dude and he takes care of people's mouths, which I believe are intimately connected with systemic health and, as we talk about in this episode, a very good indication of our systemic health and wellness. It's like a little window to the gut and the window to the inside of our bodies. He began his professional career in dental sleep medicine, treating obstructive sleep apnea, also known as OSA, and he practices currently in pediatrics. He has a patent-pending intranasal medical device called NED, which is designed to treat snoring and obstructive sleep apnea. He's also an author. He's an artist. If you find him on Instagram, you'll see his art. He's written a novella called Your Drum. He's currently the founder and CEO at Scriptis, Meat Health, and Ned. He's an active writer, reader, researcher. He shares many of his findings on his blog, which is excellent. It's called Notes to Self. He has a newsletter called The Saturday Seven, which is pretty awesome as well. And he has a podcast called Kevin Stock Radio. Seriously, you should check out his webpage, kevinstock.io. I enjoyed this conversation quite a bit. We talk about all kinds of cool things. We talk about health, wellness, carnivore diets, dental health, what he's seen in terms of dentistry, what he feels like a carnivore diet can do for dental health, some of the ways he's seen dental health go very badly in kids especially. We talk about his history doing physique competitions and his employment of a carnivore diet to gain mass. I get a lot of questions. People say, can I gain weight? Can I gain muscle on a carnivore diet? Kevin is a great example of someone who has shown us that we can. So I think you guys will really enjoy that aspect of it. I learned a lot. I think you're going to dig it. So I also want to tell you about our sponsor message. I really appreciate Ancestral Supplements, you guys. Like I said on the first episode, this is a company that I would have reached out to sponsor the podcast had they not beat me to the punch by a couple of days. I had dinner with these guys when I was at PaleoFX. They are good people. It's a small company run out of Texas. And literally, I sat down with these guys, ate huge, delicious steaks, talked about life, and I felt like I was a part of their tribe. They were so welcoming. It means a lot to me to be sponsored, to be supported in this podcast by people who are such good at heart. And I am excited to continue partnering with them. And I think that I would recommend their stuff to people unequivocally. One of the things I got to talk to them about during dinner in Austin was the quality of their supplements, where they source it from, how they are able to obtain these, and how they process it. And it's clear that they have a great intention toward the highest quality. So this podcast is proudly brought to you by the incredible Ancestral Supplements. They offer New Zealand-sourced bone marrow and nose-to-tail organ meats like liver, heart, kidney, pancreas, brain, all kinds of things like that in simple, convenient gelatin capsules. For a lot of people, it's just hard to get these organs, and I feel like these represent a very good way to quote-unquote hack this. Traditional peoples, Native Americans, our early ancestral healers, believe that eating the organs from a healthy animal would strengthen and support the health of the corresponding organ in the individual. I think this is a really interesting idea, and I think that this is a lot of wisdom. And I think that we know that these organs are incredibly valuable for humans. The traditional way of treating a person with a weak heart was to feed the person the heart of a healthy animal. Similarly, eating the kidneys of a healthy animal was believed to support urinary ailments and overall kidney health. Pancreas was fed to people with digestive and endocrine problems. Brain frequently consumed to support clear thinking. I've been taking the brain, I've been taking the thymus, and I've been taking living collagen for the last few weeks. I really like it. I appreciate what they're doing. So check out vitalsupplements.com today to see what they can do for you. Ancestral Supplements, I really agree with this. They are putting back in what the modern world has left out. So check them out. Eat your liver raw. Get the organ pills from them. Check out thymus, bone marrow, brain, pancreas, spleen, kidney, the Kidney is especially popular with people who have histamine issues as their DAO, which is diamine oxidase in kidney extract. So without further ado, welcome to this week's podcast. Enjoy this conversation with my friend, the impressive Kevin Stock. Oh, wait, just one more thing before we go to the episode. I have a newsletter, the Fundamental Health Newsletter. It's amazing. It's coming out soon. I'm working on the first issue. Go to my website, paulsaladinomd.com, to sign up for my newsletter. I think you'll find value. If you don't, you got to send me an email and tell me it stinks and tell me how to make it better. But I'm going to try and send you guys good stuff every week. So go to my website, paulsaladinomd.com/newsletter will take you directly there. Or if you go to my website, you'll see links to get to the newsletter. Sign up. Let me know how to improve it. I want to try and deliver value with that. I've got a lot of cool things coming up. Stay tuned. And here's the episode. What's up, everybody? It's another good day. I'm here with Kevin Stock. He is a gentleman that I am excited to talk to. I've been aware of his work for some time. He is a dentist in St. Louis, Missouri. One of the fascinating aspects of the carnivore diet for me are its benefits on dental health. And I am fascinated by Weston Price. I'm sure this gentleman is as well. You know, and so we are going to dig right into it and talk about dental health as a mirror for systemic health. I'm with one of the experts, and Kevin himself runs a bunch of websites in the carnivore community, which I will link to below. They are meat.health and kevinstock.io. Kevin, it's a pleasure, man. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, I'm excited to be on here, so it's going to be fun to chat.
Yeah, so, you know, tell us a little bit about your background. Like, I think it's so interesting to hear everyone's individual story about how they found this crazy, amazing thing called the carnivore diet. Like you said, you've been doing this diet for 2 years.
Yep.
I always see your stuff online. Tell me the story, man. This is fascinating stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been fascinated with nutrition for decades. Like that's not an exaggeration. So I came to the carnivore diet. I thought it was similar to most people, but now that I've like worked with probably thousands of people, it seems like the number one reason people come to the carnivore diet is, I'm going to just say fat loss seems to be high on the list. And that was as a kid, I was a overweight kid, and like a lot of overweight kids didn't want to be overweight, which led to years of diet experiments and body transformations from getting really big and really frail. And eventually I thought found what was like an ideal diet. And then a number of years ago, my number one priority, which was always the vanity side of health, was, you know, building muscle and losing fat. It changed to, I really wanted to optimize mental performance. Long story short, I was running a couple different companies and stressed and working a lot of hours. And I was like, I need more mental capacity. So it was basically, I thought I was giving up some of the physical aspects, of building muscle, losing fat. I'm like, I just want to find how I'm going to function best. And through lots of research and testing and all kinds of things, I eventually started eating basically just meat. I remember it was early 2017. I was basically eating just meat, and MCT oil was the only non-animal based product I was eating. And then I wasn't even aware of this carnivore community at that time. Maybe it was just kicking up. I don't know. But now it seems like it's grown quite a bit. But people sending me, Dr. Baker on Rogan saying, hey, there's this other doc who's eating just like you. I'm like, oh, there's a couple weirdos like me out there. But basically, long story short, I came to it as a way to optimize mental performance. And not only did I find that, but I found you don't have to give up the physical side of building muscle, losing fat as well. You can kind of have your cake and eat it too, so to speak.
Yeah, I want to dig into that because I know that you've done figure or bodybuilding competitions.
Yeah, I've done a few physique competitions. Uh-huh. And I've never had any interest in being a bodybuilder, but just the vanity side of like wanting to look good, you know? But when I was in dental school, I started sharing some of the findings I'd found out over the preceding years. And so I trained a bunch of people about, hey, this is what I'm doing to build muscle and lose fat, and kind of just to practice what I preached. I, did a couple competitions to, kind of show how it works.
Yeah. Some of your results online are pretty impressive. I'm not sure where the best place people can go to see your ripped physique is, but I know I've seen them in passing and I'm like, damn, dude is jacked.
Yeah, well, I post some up maybe Instagram or something like that.
Something like that, yeah. Well, I mean, I think that like this looking good naked is probably the single biggest motivation for people.
It is. It is. I'll tell you, when people start off carnivore and that's their number one priority, sometimes I get a little nervous. Because people that have, and we can probably go into this more detail later if you want, but like people that have done a bunch of dieting and things like that to try and find fat loss, and they've struggled, a lot of times their metabolic health is not in a great place and their hormones are not in a great place. Yes. And they're told, oh, I can go eat as much meat as I want, and they do, which is fine, that's great and all, but then they, you know, a lot of people, they'll gain weight. They'll be like, oh, this is not what I was expecting. I'm like, look, you need to understand the whole picture a little bit better. So we can talk about more of the big picture if you want.
I think we should definitely dive into that, because that's one of the things I've been thinking about a lot, is this kind of like underlying metabolic health and insulin resistance, you know?
Yeah.
I've been listening to Ray Cronise recently, because I'm going on a podcast soon with Rich Roll, and we're going to kind of do like two sides of the same coin, talk about vegan diets and carnivore diets. And so I'm trying to understand what Ray Cronise is saying. And one of the things that he says is that people can't have a broken metabolism. And I think that's wrong. People can definitely have a broken metabolism.
See, I think what people get tripped up on is the word broken, because when I think someone is in a quote unquote broken metabolic state, it's not that the metabolism is broken. It's functioning like it should, but because of what they're doing in life, it is in such a position that, you know, that's what the metabolism should do. If you're not eating, let's say you're on a starvation diet, the metabolism is supposed to drop. Okay. That's how it's supposed to work. So it's not broken. It's functioning like it should, but the inputs are making it seem like it's quote unquote broken.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think this is where people misunderstand the concept. One of the things that Ray Cronise says is that when he eats sashimi salmon, or if he eats salmon 5 times, he'll have diabetes. And I kind of like fall out of my chair and I go, that doesn't make any sense evolutionarily. And
no, it doesn't make any sense.
He's not here to answer the claims, but in my mind, I'm thinking, yeah, I mean, maybe if you're eating it with carbohydrates, and maybe if you're really insulin resistant at baseline, but I've never seen human physiology behave like that in my mind.
No.
This is probably the kind of stuff I'll be talking with Rich about. There's no evidence that...
That doesn't make any sense to me.
...cause insulin resistance. But if you have underlying insulin resistance, you know, that I would say is like broken metabolic physiology, and that's going to make you behave a little funny.
Sure.
If you eat protein and carbohydrates together, people could have a strange reaction to this. So tell me more about what you're thinking about metabolism and how you approach clients with that. Is there transitioning, or how do you frame this whole thing from a bigger perspective?
Yeah. And since summer's coming up here, I've been talking a lot about fat loss recently. I think what most people need to realize is that there's a few things when it comes to fat loss. One is like, what's your real goal? Okay. A lot of people aren't really clear what they want. Like, do you want to get like competition lean? Okay. You need to know that going into it. Are you just looking to lose a few pounds? What time frame are you looking at? Like, do you just want to like do something for a month, look good for a month, and who cares about the long-term consequences? Are you looking for like long-term fat loss? Like, people need to get very clear on that first. And then that'll dictate, you know, what approach I would recommend. But just assuming someone wants to like, hey, I want long-term health and, you know, healthy body fat. The first thing is what have you been doing and things like that. But basically you need to get healthy first. Like you're saying, it's a lot of people have some degree of insulin resistance, even if they don't know it, even if they're not diabetic, not pre-diabetic. There's a good chance, like if you're overweight, you got some degree of insulin resistance. So my first recommendation is always like, I call it like get healthy stage. I'm like, okay, eat meat. Okay. Get rid of the carbohydrates. Don't limit your appetite. We need your appetite hormones. We need those to regulate. You need to put on lean body mass. So I recommend resistance training. Like if you just do those two steps, like eat until you're satiated. I'm not saying stuff yourself, get into a resistance training program. Like you that's going to be like your number one thing to start fighting off this insulin resistance. And do this for like months and months and months, like years if you need it, like depending on the amount of damage that you've done. And you'll get to a place, most people, if they just do those two things, their body fat's going to get to a place where like they're happy with it anyways. Like a lot of people don't want to get like shredded, stage ripped. Now, if you want to do that, there's some more we can do, what I call, like, that's part one, get healthy. Part two would be some additional tricks you can do, you know, with the carnivore diet to take fat loss to a more extreme level. And that comes with consequences as well. Whenever you're getting body fat down into like mid, low single digits, like, the body doesn't want to be there, and there's consequences. There's little tricks, like something I call fat cycling, to mitigate some of these negative consequences. And I can go more into how, like, I would tell someone, like, hey, if you want to get super ripped, these are some strategies I would do. But those strategies don't matter unless you've done part one first. Or you're really digging a hole. Where, so an example I'll give is, like, I'll often have someone says, you know, look, I'm eating 1.5 pounds of meat, or I'm eating 1,500 calories a day. I'm doing an hour of cardio a day. I'm doing weights 4 times a week. I got 20% body fat. I want to get down to 15% body fat. I'm like, okay, look, you can start doing 2 hours of cardio a day. You can drop your food intake to 1 pound of meat a day. Like, those are your two big levers that you can pull to lose fat, you know, additional fat. But you are going to put yourself in just such a horrible state of starvation and malnutrition. So that whenever your willpower gives up, like, the amount of damage is going to, it's going to swing back and more some. That's why you see when people go on diets and then they get off them, like, they always, like, they end up with more weight than they did before they started.
It's kind of a, yeah, it's not a sustainable process unless you do it well.
Right.
So you would say the first phase is, like, get healthy, you know, do some resistance exercise and eat animals. And you're saying eat meat, but I'm curious, you know, where do you fall in, like, or tell us a little bit about your diet. I'm a big proponent of, like, nose to tail eating, but I know that some people really thrive on just eating steaks. So what kind of stuff helps you function the best in terms of a carnivore diet or your diet in general?
That's a good question. So I don't fall on any side of the spectrum, so to speak, because I'm very research science oriented person. And I'm all for hypothesis, but unless those hypotheses are, like, tested, I have a hard time just being like, oh, I'm all for that side. I look at both sides of hypotheses. Like you said, there's some people that just eat muscle meat for 20 years and they are thriving. Like, that's someone can make a hypothesis that you only need muscle meat, and here is a case study. I'm like, okay, there's some evidence. And then there's some people like yourself that say, hey, I think nose to tail is the best way to go. A hypothesis for why that might be so, because I know you recommend eating collagen to balance glycine and methionine, and I'm like, it makes sense. However, if you don't do that, is there negative ramifications? What are those ramifications? Are we seeing those ramifications? And I like to be very convinced of something before I take a stance. As for my own diet, I eat, I'll say, probably 90%, 80% beef, muscle meat. I'll eat liver every couple weeks. I'll eat salmon every couple weeks. I eat eggs a couple times a week. That is the vast majority of my diet. And I eat various cuts. Like right now I'm doing a little bit of this fat loss example with some people just to kind of show, like, how to manipulate the diet if you want to get real lean. So I'm eating a little bit leaner cuts right now. But you know, that's the basics of it. The basics of what I'm eating.
Okay. Any supplements that you take?
No. So I have experimented taking some supplements and taking them out. I did 6 months at Meat.Health, I divided the carnivore diet into 3 levels, just a framework for helping people get started. And level 3 is basically just beef and water. And I did that level for six months. And I tested various things off that baseline. So I tested creatine, for example. It's a supplement I'd taken for countless years. I've done the research. It's very safe. It's one of the very few effective muscle building supplements. But with a diet so heavy in red meat, I'm like, is it actually going to do me any good?
Awesome question.
So I tried it in. I didn't gain any weight. I didn't really notice any differences in the gym or strength. I don't think taking a couple grams a day is going to hurt anything, but I also don't think it's going to help anything. That's kind of my view of a lot of supplements. My view on supplements is, like, they should supplement your diet. And if you're eating a proper diet that's basically full of the nutrition. Like you shouldn't really need a lot of supplements. If you're eating a diet that has holes in it, perhaps supplements can help fill those holes. There's a lot of research that shows like trying to supplement to fill holes doesn't work. But I mean, it makes sense to try. So that's kind of my view on supplements.
Yeah. With regard to creatine, I mean, I don't know the number off the top of my head. I think it's something like 5+ grams.
About 5 grams.
In a pound of meat. And so, I mean, if people are eating more than a pound or two of meat a day, your muscles are saturated with creatine. Exactly. You're basically just peeing the excess out. And, you know, you can do a loading phase. And creatine is a fascinating molecule. It's the main place where all of your methylation goes in your body. We know that there's some incredible studies showing that vegetarians who supplemented with creatine gained IQ points and stuff. So
brain health, huge.
Yes, huge. So if you're not eating a ton of meat, you know, creatine can certainly be valuable. But for those of us on a carnivore diet or anyone eating a reasonably large amount of meat, it's questionable whether creatine has any benefit. But creatine itself, I would agree with you, very important, safe, useful supplement.
I tell my parents because they don't eat just meat. And I'm like, look, if I were you, I'd supplement with creatine.
I think a lot of people should be.
They're not weightlifters, not bodybuilders. It's basically a health supplement, but it has benefits in the gym as well.
Absolutely. I think if people are listening to this and they're eating a keto diet or a paleo diet and you're eating a pound or less of meat a day, I think you're going to see benefits of creatine. Yeah. So this is a question that you can really help weigh in on too. A lot of times, it's so funny because like half the world wants to ask me, are you going to overactivate mTOR on a carnivore diet? And the other half wants to ask me, how do I get big and ripped on a carnivore diet? Which are like two sides of the mTOR equation.
Yep, so that and IGF-1.
Right. So talk to me, like let's talk to the people who ask me, how do I get big and ripped on a carnivore diet? Do you think we need carbohydrates to really trigger mTOR or insulin? Or like, how do people get like stronger and gain weight on a carnivore diet in your experience working with your clients?
That's a great question. All right. So I want to tackle that, but I do want to talk about one thing first that I tell people. Because a lot of people are concerned about mTOR and IGF-1 for longevity reasons. One of the most significant predictors of longevity is strength. And so if you just take that one, I know it's correlation, but you know, if you want to maintain and keep strength through old age, activating mTOR, IGF-1, these are ways to do that. Now, these things also fuel cancer cells, so that's the concern with it. But to answer your question, how would I go about? So this is a good example. So in April, I started doing this carnivore cut just to kind of show people like this is how I manipulated to drop body fat. Before that, let me get this right. November, December, January, February, March, 5 months, I did quote unquote a bulking phase. To put on some, people want to know, can you put on weight? So prior to that, I was just eating to appetite and whatnot. But then in November, so I normally eat about 3 pounds of meat a day is basically my standard appetite of beef. But November, I pushed up to 3.5. December, I started eating 4. January, 4.5. February, 5. I maxed out around 5 pounds of meat a day. And I did that for 5 months, increasing the eating. And like, look,
five pounds a day.
And you know what? This is, people ask me, they're like, I can't eat. I'm like, incrementally, like I eat 5 pounds a day and it's not a big deal.
How big are you? How tall are you? How much do you weigh?
So I am 5'11". I hover in the 160s.
Wow. So this And you're eating 5 pounds of meat a day.
Yeah, I can. On the flip side, which is interesting, I can eat 2.5 pounds of meat a day, half of that, and it's not like a big deal.
Right.
So, because like right now I'm doing this cut and I'm eating, you know, 2.5 to 3 pounds of meat a day. Coming off eating 5 pounds of meat, like that's a drastic drop in intake. But I feel fine. My energy's good. And it's like, I'm not starving at all. I go to bed with a slight feel. I tell people, I'm like, if you want to lose weight, if you go to bed with the feeling like I could eat, that's usually a good indication.
Right.
You don't need to count calories, but I could eat. Not starving. You don't want to go to bed starving, a lot of reasons. But like, I could eat. That's a good feeling. But anyways, back to your question, can you build muscle? Yeah. Like, look, I put on strength, size. I put on some body fat during those 5 months. But really, you just got to eat. If you're not eating more than your baseline, so to speak, you know, muscle needs fuel and it's metabolically hungry. So it's like you got to feed it.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Yeah, I think people, the interesting thing, kind of the double-edged sword of the carnivore diet is it's so satiating, which is why it helps so many people lose weight.
Yeah.
But I think it's harder for people to overeat on the carnivore diet.
It is.
I think the equation holds and that it's just a matter of overeating. Like if you want to grow muscle and you want to get bigger, you just have to eat more.
Yeah. And it's easy to eat carbs.
Exactly.
And so that's the thing. It's easy to eat carbs. I'm going to tell you, I'm not 100% convinced. I've read a lot of research on it. You can maximize your muscle protein synthesis with just protein alone. You don't need the carbs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I am not convinced yet,
right,
anecdotally, personal experience, if I was going to try and maximize muscle in the next 6 months, I would probably include carbohydrate.
Right. What would you include?
Post-workout carbs. And depending on my approach that I was going to take, because I've done cyclic carbohydrates with, extreme success for the fat loss side, but also you do it for the muscle building side, on the muscles I want to bring up the most, like I'm always trying to bring up my shoulders because I think big round shoulders look awesome. Mm-hmm. So like when I do shoulders, I'd eat more carbs post-workout. Uh-huh. What would I eat is a good question. I would want to limit anti-nutrients as much as possible. I would probably lean towards things like raw honey. I would lean towards, if I peel the sweet potato and put it in a pressure cooker to really kind of nuke out all the bad while keeping some of the carbs that are not as dangerous. White rice, maybe. There's no real nutrition benefit to that, but if I was just trying to add some carbs, that might be something that's pretty benign. I'm not going to do that. And then we're start talking short-term versus long-term muscle gains. Like, so for short-term muscle gains, that might be ideal. But long-term, if you start building up a little bit of insulin resistance, you start getting joint pain, things like that. It's like, hey, if you didn't have any of those carbs and you didn't have any of those problems, could you have built more muscle over time leaving those out? I think that's an important consideration people just don't think about.
Exactly. And I mean, everybody's got to decide what their goals are, and there are ways to do it. And that's kind of how I've talked about it with people too. I mean, there are people who suggest that you can maximize protein synthesis or muscle building with just protein. But yeah, I think for some people it's probably easier with insulin related to the carbs, but that comes with a downside too.
And it does.
And it's interesting that you note that if you were going to eat a sweet potato, that you would peel it and eat in a pressure cooker. And that's the indigenous way. I mean, generally speaking, if we look at the way indigenous cultures have always prepared plants, they spend hours and days preparing plants sometimes. And I was just talking with a gentleman the other day who was, who lived with a lot of indigenous tribes when he was in the military. And that was what he said. He said, when they were preparing, like the women were preparing the plants all day long. I mean, whether they were like chewing it and spitting it out to ferment it, I think it's this idea that like, we don't do that with plants anymore. We've sort of forgotten, hey, most of them are toxic. And if you really want to eat them, you better know how to avoid those toxins if you want optimal health or accept the consequences, whether that be joint pain, insulin resistance, et cetera. So if you want to eat a sweet potato, you probably have to pressure cook the crap out of it or something like detoxify it. There are lectins in white rice. Some people might react to them, might not.
Yep.
Not something that I include every day either. So if people wanted to get like just sliced, like just shredded, how do you do that? And like you said, I think that the caveat for people to know is that there are metabolic consequences to that too, which is probably some hypogonadism, some hormonal dysregulation when you get that low. But if people, for the sake of vanity, which we admit is important for some people, or they have some sort of a mental goal, they really wanted to get like super shredded, what's the other side of the equation? How do you do that with people?
So if we just assume like they did part one right, they got their metabolism in a healthy place, they've been doing resistance training, they just want to get sliced up. It depends on where they're at that time and what they want to get to. But let's just keep it pretty simple. There's two main levers that people can pull. One is decreasing energy going in, and we can talk about the calories don't matter thing, but at the end of the day, calories are energy. And like, if you believe in physics, the conservation of energy can't be neither created nor destroyed. Like it goes in your mouth. It's got three possible places it can go. You can pass through your GI system, you can go into your body and you can use it, or you're going to store it. Like that's what's happening with the energy. So you can decrease that energy consumption by eating less calories. You can increase your energy expenditure. I think cardio is probably the most effective way to do that. And what I recommend is doing those two, pulling those two levers gradually. And there's interesting combinations that you can do. For example, I started this month out doing, I added 15 minutes of cardio 3 to 4 days a week. And then the next week I bumped it 20 minutes and 25 minutes and 30 minutes this week. And normally I was more aggressive with my diet this time, probably because I announced to people that I was doing this, but more normally what I would do is I would do a more gradual decrease in food consumption. So if I was eating 5 pounds, I would drop it to 4 pounds and then 3.5, and just gradually pull those two levers over time. And what I do to help mitigate, you know, feeling bad or hormonal issues is I include quote unquote fat cycling, where every 3 days or on the body part building, or like on my shoulder day, I'm going to bump up my calories that day. I'm going to have eat more fat because protein's high every day. And one of the things when I'll eat slightly leaner as well, but then I recoup that on the third day or the fourth day by eating a little bit higher fat that day. So that's the general, if we did talk about the 80-20 rule, the 20% of things right there, that's going to get you 80% of the results. Those are just the three little things that I would do.
Cool. And I think people are can use this diet in a lot of different ways. Now, if we back up a little bit, you know, you said that you were sort of always trying to optimize. I mean, one of the parts of the story that I kind of glossed over that I want to hear a little more about is like, how did you end up deciding that meat was what you were going to do? I mean, that was tell me about that. Like, so you're doing this like bio optimization, you're biohacking, you're like, I want to kick the most ass possible. Like, how did you decide that that was meat? And what did you notice when you did that?
So I was already eating meat, and it really, so what happened is I just looked at my diet. I ate a lot of meat and I ate a lot of vegetables. Those were the two equations. And I'm like, you know, it sounds crazy, but like I started researching plants more. And everything from lectins, like you mentioned, I did a total lectin avoidance diet, which I still had some plants in the diet at that time. And I was like, I feel a little bit better. And then, you know, as I fell down the rabbit hole, I kept eliminating plants, which got me to basically all meat. And as I was doing that, I started eating more and more red meat. So previously I was eating a lot of lean meat. I was eating a lot of chicken and whatnot. And I started eating more red meat, mainly because of the fat. I was like, I want to get a little bit more fat in my diet. And if I'm getting rid of all these vegetables, I need some more nutrients. And I knew chicken, you know, it's all right, but it's not great. So that led me down to basically just meat. And I had the MCT oil in for a while, cause I was like, that's kind of a brain hack, a kind of a cheat into ketosis. And, I didn't mention this, but my first step, I'd done a ketogenic diet prior to this. But I had always called it like, I cheated on the keto. Cause I, as someone interested in maintaining body composition, dropping my protein below 1 gram per pound of body weight was like almost heresy. But this time I was like, I'm going to go full keto. And I limited my protein intake to 0.75 grams per pound, which I'd never done. I was like, this is a terrible idea, but I'm going to try it for brain health. Man, that was a bad idea. I lost so much muscle fast. Yeah. And there's all kinds of research saying like when you're in ketosis, it's, you know, it's muscle sparing, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, look, yeah, I got firsthand experience. Like I lost a lot of muscle. And I didn't necessarily feel all that much better, which led me to removing more and more plants. So basically I was on a keto diet that was eliminating plants at a pretty rapid pace, which led to just a meat diet. And then when I found a community of people that are already doing this, I was like, wow, this is really interesting. Then I dumped the MCT oil and just been eating meat ever since.
How did you feel? Like, so in that transition, what did you notice when you did all that? Like what happened?
So when I switched to keto, I didn't notice nothing significant. Like I was in deep ketosis and I was like, man, I'm supposed to have all this brain power, but you know, I feel all right, but not like Superman yet. When I started including a lot of red meat is when I started feeling a lot better. That's when my energy, that's when I was able to like start ditching coffee because my energy was more consistent. The question that I'm asked a lot, I'm like, was it the eating of more red meat or was it the decrease of the plant material that made you feel better? Or was it the combination of both? I think in my case, it's probably the combination of both that got me to be like, man, I'm feeling satiated. I feel like my energy stabilized. I'm not relying on coffee to get me through the day. I'm able to work in this stressful environment and I'm making it through. And combine that with giving up on the 0.75 grams of protein a day, because that was a natural consequence of starting to eat so much red meat. I felt much better. That I started putting my muscle mass back on again. So it was a combination of those things that, you know, I was like, this is really the way I need to be eating.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I kind of had the same journey myself. It was like, I was paleo and then I was autoimmune paleo. And then as I learned more about plants, it was like, what the heck is left? I mean, avocado and lettuce, like avocado and arugula. And I'm sure I could find some toxins in those. And then it was like, yeah. Well, I mean, it's kind of the same story. You know, I just did a podcast with Sally Norton talking about oxalates.
Yeah.
You eliminate, if you want to get rid of oxalates, which I think she makes a very compelling case for a lot of people.
She does.
Then you're not left with a lot of foods, honestly. Yep. I mean, there are some low oxalate foods. But then, you know, for instance, if you eliminate oxalates, you say, well, maybe some of the brassica vegetables like kale, like dino kale is like not a whole lot of oxalates, but curly green kale is more oxalates. So then you can eat dino kale. It's like, well, then I think like, well, you probably don't want to eat dino kale either because that has glucosinolates, which I would argue are toxic.
Yep.
Tocopherolane precursors. I've talked about that ad nauseum on many. Then you're like, well, that's the reason not to eat that. And you basically just realize in the very same way, like, oh shit, man, like plants don't want to get eaten. Duh. Like there's something in every plant. And, you know, we don't think fructose is beneficial long-term. And so why are we eating plants in general? And then, so I agree with you. I get asked the same question. Is meat magic? Does meat heal? Or is it the removal of plants? And it's clearly both. You know, you put in this hugely nutrient dense food source and you take out all the toxins and you feel like Superman.
Yeah. So, and over once I started doing this crazy diet, so to speak, like 2.5 years ago, I started digging into more and more research. And I, for most of my career, I've been very much, I call it like looking through the microscope of research. Like I'd look at research papers and things like that. And well, I started zooming out more and kind of looking at like what makes sense, like as a true ancestral diet. And so I've been reading and studying and writing about this a lot. And man, if you zoom out and you see like the evolution of the human species over time up until the agricultural revolution, 12,000 years ago, like, and since then is really just, you know, it's just a nick of time. The evidence is so compelling that like humans, we ate meat. Like, did we supplement it with some seasonal fruits and some opportunistic plants? Probably. But like, it was very much a minuscule part of our diet for the vast majority of human evolution, especially modern human species, Homo sapiens. And like when my zooming out research really settled in, I was like, man, I've been looking through the lens at all these little, you know, biochemical reactions, how this works, how that works. Like, man, if I just use like common sense and kind of like zoomed out, it's like, this is not that crazy. Actually, the food we are eating today is much crazier. Like these foods did not exist, you know, 100 years ago, a lot of them. Like these things are manipulate. The plants we're eating today did not, like the vast majority did not exist, were not eaten throughout most of human evolution. Like the three biggest sources of calories, which is, you know, wheat, corn, and rice, like these things were not eaten at all throughout human evolution. And now that makes up the majority of calories on the earth. Like to me, that I was like, man, this is, it's common sense when you zoom out and look at the big picture a little bit. But I mean, I was guilty of like just not zooming out. And I think it's probably common for a lot of, you know, research scientists besides paleontologists and anthropologists. Like it's easy to miss the big picture.
It's hard to think about things in the actual timeline of human evolution. You know, I did a podcast with Miki Bendor.
Yeah. I mean, he's got great research.
He does. And I mean, it's like Homo erectus has been around for 1.8 million years.
Very successful species.
1.8 million years. Homo sapiens, probably 350,000 years. Neanderthals, something like that. They're extinct now. Mostly extinct, probably. There's a few Neanderthals walking the earth, perhaps. Not many. And then, you know, you think about it like, okay, Homo sapiens is pretty much Homo erectus. Not totally, but 350,000 years ago, how long have we been farming rice? 3,000 years?
Right.
You know, it's the blink of an eye. And it's, people say, oh, Asians have been eating rice forever. And you're like, actually, no.
No, yeah.
Like agrarianism, farming, whether it's wheat, corn, or rice is a really new invention. You know, Jared Diamond has this awesome lecture called, I'm going to miss the title. It's something like The Worst Mistake in Human History. And it's just about the cult of the seed, as he would call it. He's the guy who wrote Collapse and Guns, Germs, and Steel. Just the way his theory, I think, is so compelling, the way that starting to farm grains really changed who we are as people and has changed our nutrition. So if anyone believes that grains are a part of any sort of human history, I would hope that we could disabuse them of that notion. So
I agree. And it's not like I don't discount adaptation, human adaptation to food in the last 10,000 years. Like obviously, like we adults can, some adults can drink milk now. Like that was not a thing, not in the distant past. Like everyone is lactose intolerant after, you know, being weaned off milk. But now we are able to, you know, have lactase persist into adulthood. Like that's an adaptive evolutionary thing. So it's like we have adapted to some things, like, so now we can have some dairy into adulthood, but like we haven't adapted to eating a plant-based diet, just turning the entire diet on its head. Like that's, to me, that's just absurd.
And one of the things I think is crazy is that once we started farming, I would argue that natural selection kind of went away. We almost, I mean, like there's no natural selection when we're, it just seems to me that from an evolutionary perspective, when you're hunting and gathering in the environment, there's a real natural selective pressure. But when everyone can eat the same food out of the garden, like there's no way to select for someone who's more adapted for that food than someone else. And so there's no way that our genes are going to really be selected for. I think that with the right selective pressures, perhaps humans could evolve, you know, into like some species that tolerates the grains better. But I don't think that's happened in any way, shape, or form.
Well, yeah, it may devolve into into this a species that can't eat those things. Like it's like there's interesting research that shows like how the human brain has been shrinking over the last 10,000 years. And it's like, well, are we evolving? Yeah, I guess we're evolving. Maybe I'd better call it devolving, but
it's scary to think about. So we are both fans of Weston Price, and Weston Price is like the man, you know.
Fellow dentist right there.
He was a dentist. So tell us the story of Weston Price from your perspective and what he found, because he's your, you know, he's your lineage, you know, and then tell me a little bit about what you see in terms of what you think in terms of oral health and what is ideal for oral health. Because I think as we will see with the story of Weston Price, dental health, which is one of the reasons I was so excited to talk to you, dental health I see as a microcosm that is reflected of the whole body's health, you know, and I think it might have been someone else that said, you know, like you can tell how healthy someone is by looking in their mouth. And I couldn't agree more than that.
Yep. So I think whether it's Weston Price or there's a number of early explorer scientists that explore the world and they recorded their observations. And an interesting observation that Weston Price makes, but also a number of other explorer scientists, is always dental health. And they're like, oh, these indigenous people that are eating their natural diet, meat-based diets, their dental health, they don't have dental decay, they don't have dental malformities. And they always note that. And an interesting reason why is like, look, a dentist has a unique opportunity. If you heard the saying, like your skin is out of reflection of your internal health, I think there's truth to that. But like a dentist, you can actually look. We actually get to look with the naked eye at the inside of the body there. So we can start to see things. And naturally, like these explorers look at dental health and like, look, these people have good dental health, these people have bad dental health. It's because they have that unique opportunity to, you know, peer inside the mouth. But I think there's a lot of interesting analogies and correlations with oral health and systemic health. And like one that I was thinking about before jumping on this podcast, because I knew you want to talk about that, is plaques. And so if you're familiar with dental plaque, okay, so plaque that forms on your teeth. If you don't clean it off or whatnot, if you're eating the wrong foods, it turns into tartar. It's what dentists call calculus. And if you get a bunch of calculus buildup, you get this chronic inflammation in your gums and causes periodontitis. And you know, this research that is coming out, the one that we were talking about is, was it Pritchard? 2017 research has shown this link between periodontitis and neurodegenerative disease. We have these same kinds of bacteria. It's also a similar process because like in neurodegenerative disease, you got these amyloid plaques that are building up in your teeth. You get these plaques that are building up in your coronary arteries. You get these plaques that are building up. It's an interesting, it's not, well, it's not a perfect analogy. It's an interesting thing that, you know, you look in the mouth, you know, your gums are inflamed. Like that's a chronic inflammatory state. That's a similar thing that's happening into people's insides. The only thing is, as a dentist, I can just, you can open your mouth and I can see, look, you got chronic inflammation. You kind of have to flay someone open to be like, hey, let's see if you got any internal inflammation. But yeah, it's a lot of these things that you can see in the mouth that are, I think the mouth is good. It's a good analogy a lot of times. And one of the scary things is, so I treat pediatric patients twice a week, and you'd be shocked at how many, like I'm pulling teeth left and right. Like it's a normal thing to be able to chuck, to be needing to chuck teeth out of kids. And I'm like, it's not a normal thing that your teeth are rotting out of your mouth, especially at such a young age. And they got, you know, their gums are all chronically inflamed. They got gingivitis. These are not normal processes. And the food they were putting in our mouth is a very significant contributor to that. And luckily as a dentist, we can see that. But like once that food goes into your mouth, to think that those same food is not doing damage on the inside is like that. I think that's foolish, even though because we can't see it, doesn't mean there's not damage happening. Like gingivitis, if you have chronically inflamed gums, you know what that feels like? It doesn't feel like anything. Like it doesn't hurt. So, I mean, you could be feeling just fine. Oh, I'm eating these, whatever it is. And you can feel just fine. Well, there's an insidious nature to damage. Like if you have a cavity, good chance you don't feel that pain until it's quite significant. So I think there's a lot of good associations, relations with oral health and systemic health.
And so this paper that you were talking about, I pulled it up here. I can do a screen share for people that are watching on YouTube, and I'll just show people the paper. It's pretty cool paper. So in this paper, what Kevin is talking about is that, the title of the paper is Periodontitis, Microbes and Their Role in Alzheimer's Disease. It is by Ann Pritchard from 2017. I'll link to it in the show notes, but it's the idea that there have been correlates between this the amount of P. gingivalis and incidence of these neurodegenerative diseases, suggesting that perhaps, and I think it's not too far a cry from what we would imagine to be the case, that your oral health is going to influence your systemic health, and that these microbes in the mouth can potentially even affect immunologic things in the brain. I mean, it's not very far from the brain. And we see this in medicine. You know, people have oral herpes, HSV-1 around the mouth. They can get, herpes, they can get temporal inflammation, or they can get herpes in the brain connected with that. So anything around the mouth is definitely going to be connected with the brain. And the concern is that if you have overgrowth of P. gingivalis, which is presumably, one of these bacteria associated with periodontitis, gingivitis, gingival disease, that this could be something that is a precursor lesion for Alzheimer's neurodegenerative diseases, suggesting, okay, what's going on here? And then the follow-up question, or, kind of the lead-in here, is that there's been some studies that show that low-carbohydrate diets really help with this. Isn't that the case, that they've done low-carbohydrate trials and they show a reduction in P. gingivalis?
Yeah, and I'm not sure if this is widely known. I assumed it was, but maybe it's not. Like, decay, like, the bacteria in your mouth are not going to cause decay in the absence of carbohydrate. You're not going to get decay. Like they require carbohydrates to produce the acid that decays your enamel. And so when you get rid of that, like your oral health, like it's automatically improved. You're taking away one of the biggest issues right off the bat. So this research is super interesting because one of the things that she talks about in the paper is these bacteria that they're finding in patients with Alzheimer's. What happens is these amyloid beta proteins have a antimicrobial effect. So these amyloid proteins, which are hallmarks of neurodegenerative disease, are going to get rid of this bacteria basically. But in doing so, those proteins are neurotoxic. Like they are like poison to your neurons, which I, something else that it, just because I've studied it and, have significant background in sleep, which is another interesting analogy between the mouth and the rest of the body. So in the mouth, you have saliva. It acts as basically like a, like like giving your teeth a bath. Okay. It keeps everything clean. In your body, it's analogous to the lymphatic system. Well, in the brain, you have something called the glymphatic system. And the glymphatic system is used to clean out these amyloid proteins. But interesting thing is, you're not sleeping. The glymphatic system is upregulated like 10 to 20% during non-REM sleep. But people, old people especially, that aren't sleeping, you get these amyloid proteins that are up there. And if you're not getting good sleep, they're not getting cleaned out. You have a vicious cycle between diet, sleep, and a buildup of plaques in your brain that is just, it's just, you're just doomed.
And I think that this is probably something that is just coming to public attention now, but these amyloid beta plaques, if people have heard Alzheimer's, they've probably heard of amyloid plaque. And yeah. I think for the longest time, you know, people thought that amyloid was the problem, and it may be participating, but it may be similar to part of the cholesterol story in the sense that like amyloid probably serves a very important role in the human body. Like you're suggesting, people believe now that it's antimicrobial. And all the studies that have been done with amyloid beta antibodies or trying to get rid of amyloid beta have failed miserably. Like clearly getting rid of amyloid is not the answer for Alzheimer's. And this study would suggest, like you're saying, that perhaps there's an immunologic component to amyloid. Maybe it has an antibacterial role. And there's some precursor insult, whether it's bacteria, whether it's an autoimmune process in the brain. Something is going on in the brain, whether this porphyria gingivalis, or I think I said the first part of the name wrong, but P. gingivalis, is going to the brain, you know, and then the amyloid is responding. There's something going on. And I love that you highlighted this. I mean, I think that generally I'm not even aware of this. So I think that a lot of people will benefit from hearing this again. Like, so my impression is that cavities form in the mouth when we eat sugar, that we have to eat carbohydrate, but that affects the bacteria, that the bacteria create acid, which changes the pH of the saliva, making things more acidic, and that is sort of that is the precursor to cavity formation in the mouth. Am I thinking about that properly?
Yeah, you're right on it. And the next question I get from people is, well, can I reverse my cavities on a carnivore diet? And now we can talk about that. Like, a good way to think about a tooth is if you think about an apple, like the peel, that's the enamel. Let's just say that it's thicker than the peel of an apple, but that's, if a cavity is still in the enamel, there's a chance that you can remineralize it, you know, take good, you know, get rid of the sugar. There's a chance once it eats past that enamel, it's into the dentin, the pulp of the tooth, I'd get it filled. But if you want to be risky and try some, test it out, then you can. But I get that question a lot. So people might be wondering.
I think people can. And I'm not a dentist, so I don't look at teeth. I don't know how many of these were in the enamel versus the dentin. But when I was a vegan 14 years ago, I was convinced that I was doing the right thing. And I went to see a dentist and they said, you have 7 cavities. And I lost my shit. I was like, what do you mean I have 7 cavities? I'm doing the healthiest diet on the planet. I'm sure. And I didn't get any of them filled and none of them progressed, but I shortly thereafter stopped being a vegan and went to like paleo, strictly paleo for probably 10 years. And then I've been carnivore. So I haven't had problems with it since. So I think that whatever they were, I think that there was some reprogression in my case, but
yeah, remineralization. Yeah. And I mean, that can happen as long as it's not progressed. You know, the literature says as long as it's not progressed through the enamel, you can reverse it. But
now, one of the things that I've seen in the carnivore community that would be interesting to ask you about is that, and I've noticed this myself, I think Weston A. Price noticed this, that some people eating carnivore diets do get calculus, but it doesn't seem to be the same as like plaque-based calculus. Can you talk to me about that? I mean, like, you know, people say like, oh, I had like this thing that's like chipped off my tooth, you know, but they're not having cavities.
Yeah. So in the limited, you know, sample size that we kind of have, I notice it common in people when they're starting, because what happens is their body, if you're going from a carb-based diet to just an all-meat diet, you're going to have a massive fluid rebalancing in your body going on. And a lot of times it's going to result in dry mouth. And the dry mouth is what's going to cause the buildup of the calculus. What I've seen in a lot of people is once they've gotten adapted, they got the calculus off, they went to the dental hygienist, and they got it all cleaned up, and their regular saliva is back in normal order, it's not been an issue. But maybe people persist with it. I don't have that much data around this, whereas people that have been on a pure carnivore diet long term, and they get their teeth cleaned and calculus rebuilds up over time. You know, if it's not associated with chronic inflammation, it's not causing periodontitis, probably not a problem. But I don't know if we're seeing that.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe you could tell me something I don't know. Like, there's people that just have huge calculus problems and they've been carnivore for a long time and they just don't know how to get rid of it. But dry mouth is what I found to be the number one suspect. And that's common early on when you're getting transitioned.
Yeah, it is interesting. I think that most people who have thought about carnivore, well, people who have tried carnivore will say that there is this transitional phase. You can have GI symptoms. There can be electrolyte shifts. You know, it can be, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't mean that you're doing the thing wrong. It just means your body is rebalancing. And so it's interesting for people to know that it's important. And, you know, I think that for a lot of people, there's probably going to be a shift in the fluid in the mouth and stuff, and it's possible. Yeah. And I'm not sure how long, you know, I'm not sure that I've heard about it reoccurring. I've just heard of it occurring in people and noticed a little bit of calculus in my mouth, but not with any clear signs. I mean, I'm not a dentist, but I look at my gums and I'm like, yeah, they don't look inflamed. They're not bleeding.
Right.
I think a lot about oral hygiene myself. So I do like water pick and I brush, you know, and I floss every day, twice a day. And so I think about it a ton, but, I don't want it to bleed, you know? So I thought it's a really interesting thing. The other question that comes up around teeth that I think is super fascinating is this idea of evolutionary origins of teeth, and can teeth give us any sort of perspective on where we've come from and who we are? You know, as we talked about, I talked to Miki Bendor, we've looked at nitrogen, where there's nitrogen levels of these early Neanderthals and Homo sapiens, which suggests that we were high-level trophic carnivores. One of the arguments against carnivory that I hear sometimes is, hey, we've got molars, you know, like, but then Miki says that our jaw is kind of built to chew meat as well. So what's your take on this from a dental perspective? You know, like, what do the human teeth look like to you? Do you think that it means we're omnivores or we shouldn't just be eating meat?
Well, I think like they miss I mean, it's a common argument that that I've heard a lot, but to me, it's like, it's very obvious. They're just missing the big picture. Like, obviously we are primates and primates have similar teeth and number, size, and shape. Like that is our heritage, is a primate heritage. That's the same reason we have fingernails and we don't have claws, like, because we're primates. That doesn't mean like various structures haven't evolved, but like that's our evolutionary heritage. Like, for example, our molars we have molars like primates have molars, but ours are more ridged like wolves versus flat like sheep. And like you mentioned, like our jaw is much more vertical than rotary, which is like a herbivore. So like to me, like that argument doesn't make any sense at all.
Well, that's interesting because I didn't know about the flat versus ridged molars.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe what I should do, or, you know, I should look at, you know, what the molar of I guess a sheep is a ruminant, but it would be interesting to see. I would love to see, you know, like what a chimpanzee molar looks like versus a human molar. And yeah, I think it's clear, you know, we are descendants of primates. And one of the things that I've suggested is that I think humans are probably facultative carnivores, which means that that animals provide the optimal food. But one of the cool things about being a human is that we're so well adapted. We're so versatile is that we can eat plants during times of starvation. You know, we don't have to eat animals all the time. Doesn't mean that they're the optimal food or that they're not full of anti-nutrients, but we're adapted to eat them when we need to survive. But I've suggested this, and I think you have as well, that plants are probably just survival food.
Yeah. And I think if we really zoom out and look, like, our primate heritage from great apes is like, look, the human species, like the first step of human species was mainly a plant eater. Like, that is the most logical thing. But as the human species evolved, we became less and less equipped to eat plants. Like, you can just look at our gut, how the gut shrank and our cecum basically became nothing. Like, we became less and less and less equipped to eat plants. We still have the ability to eat plants. Like, we know that, like, vegans don't just die. But like you said, like, we can get all our nutrition in probably the most optimal form. And the form that we have evolved over now millions of years to eat is meat. And it is nice that we still maintain some ability to eat plants.
Do you know, have you seen, like, how does a human molar compare it to like a canine molar. Theirs are probably even more ridged than us, but you
wait, a canine?
Like a dog or a wolf molar. I'm talking about the molar.
A dog's molar.
Yeah.
Oh man. You know, I would have to, I don't know. I don't know much about comparative anatomy within all kinds of species. I just know a lot of, you know, animals that grind and graze all day long.
Vertical versus rotary jaw. Yeah,
rotary, and they have much more flat teeth just for that function. But a dog, you know, I would assume it has more ridged.
Ridging. And is it true that even animals that are widely accepted to be carnivorous, like wolves, dogs, have molars as well?
I believe so. Do they call them molars, or do they have different names for them? I'm not entirely sure. Yeah. But yeah, I mean,
do you have any clients that are carnivore? I'm just curious what you've seen in your practice. You know, like, have you seen people's dental health improve? I mean, have you seen your health improve, dental health? I definitely think I know that I've seen my dental health improve. And, you know, an anecdote, you know, it's so funny because sometimes people will say like, oh, plant sugar is okay when it's in the whole food form. Well, I know that if I eat a date, my mouth hurts. like something that isn't fully healed. But like, dates make my mouth hurt. Hurt, you know,
they're
so full of sugar. Same thing with honey. And so like, I feel like I never get that with carnivore. It never like makes that like that really deep seated tooth pain. So do you have clients that are carnivores that you see in your practice? Maybe not if you're working mostly with kids or.
So that's a good question. So half of my 2 days a week, I'm treating pediatrics. And so I'm not doing a ton of nutritional counseling beyond, hey, don't eat so much sugar. If you are eating so much sugar, you know, you got to be brushing your teeth after that.
Right.
The other half, I practice in a niche area of dentistry called dental sleep medicine, which basically I treat sleep disordered breathing, which is everything from upper airway resistance syndrome, which is snoring, through obstructive sleep apnea. And there really is a significant nutritional diet component to this. Because we know people that are overweight have more collapsing of the airway and suffer more of these more from the sleep disorder. Do I tell them go carnivore? I advise nutritional strategies that are closer to something. It's just not like, oh, this guy's insane. Something that I'm like, look, weight loss is going to help. We need to get resistance training. We need to drop carbohydrate intake. We need to eat more meat-based products. So that's where I start with most patients. You know, whether they adhere, I ask, but you know, adherence is like, you know how adherence is with diet. If they're not super into it, then it's going to be tough. So, you know, basically I treat their sleep.
You know, one of the things that was striking for me when I first heard about the carnivore diet with Jordan Peterson on Joe Rogan was that he said his sleep apnea improved really quickly.
Yeah.
And I've always wondered, I mean, you can probably speak to this, in people who are not obese who have sleep apnea, I've always wondered whether it's just sort of redundant pharyngeal tissue or lymphadenopathy. And one of the hypotheses that I think of is maybe the people who are having, you know, sleep apnea have just lots of adenopathy in the neck and the pharyngeal tissue is kind of swollen, and that when they eliminate foods that are triggering them immunologically, they're able to breathe better. Does that sound reasonable to you? What do you think about that from like an obstructive sleep apnea perspective? Because you see people sometimes who are skinny who have bad apnea.
Yeah. So there's definitely an anatomical component to apnea. So like you said, people can be lean and have apnea. It's much, much, much more common for people that are overweight to have apnea. For people that are leaner to have apnea, it's generally a few things. Malampati basically is how the airway is shaped. I don't know if we don't need to go into a whole bunch of detail about that. But people are more prone or less prone to collapsing of the airway. But like you said, like something like smoking, we know that causes inflammation in the airway. That can exacerbate apnea. Things like alcohol consumption exacerbates apnea. If you're eating something that is causing an inflammatory response in the throat, and basically you have less room for air to pass because tissue is swollen, like that's going to contribute to apnea.
Yeah, that's interesting, because you hear these stories like, oh, my apnea went away in like a few days, and I'm thinking there's something going on there, you know, like,
yeah, that's interesting.
Probably I would imagine something, you know, anatomical lymphadenopathy or something improved radically with the immune system.
Yeah. I mean, that's what would make sense.
Yeah. Where do you see this all going, Kevin? Like, what are you excited about for the future with this? Like, where do you see it all going, man?
You know, I think what would be the biggest victory is just a change in perception. Like, look, does everyone need to eat all meat? I don't think so. But that's not really even that important of a question because it's not going to happen. Like, look, we know soda is bad. We know donuts are bad. Like, that's not, but people still drink soda and people still eat donuts. Okay. So like, well, that's not going to change. What I think is important is there is a lot of people that want to get healthy and they're following non-ideal strategies. Like a healthy grain-based diet or whatever. I think the biggest victory is we just change perception. Like, look, meat is health food. Animal products are health food. If we get to that, I think it's a victory to help people make more intelligent decisions. Because, like, to me, what hurts me the most are people that want to do the right thing and they're really trying, and then because of misinformation, like, they are just, you know, giving the runaround.
Yes.
So, you know, to me, the biggest thing would be is like, look, this information is out there. You can do with it what you want. But right now, the information is definitely not out there. Like, people that see who I eat, they assume I am a lunatic and that I'm going to die and that I'm surely going to get cancer. I probably have diabetes and whatnot. But, like, I don't have any of those things. So, anyways, like, I think that's the biggest thing. It's just like, you know, I think people need to know more facts and less propaganda.
I love it. Facts over propaganda, man. It's so freaking true. Like,
yeah, at least see another side. Like, because, like, I'm kind of upset about it. Like, I thought red meat was bad for a long time. And, like, I was studying nutrition and I was working hard and I got good physical results, but red meat was always, like, not a big part of my diet for most of my life. I'm kind of upset. Like, I'm like, what could my brain potential been if as a kid I was eating more meat? Because I've done a lot of research now on, like, adolescence and eating meat and improved cognition and IQ and adulthood. I'm like, man, maybe I'm only at, like, 60% of my potential if I was eating more meat as a kid.
I know, dude. I'm sure I missed out on some IQ points.
Yeah.
Mom and dad, if you're listening to this, come on.
Yeah, exactly.
I've got a niece who's a year old, and I'm always telling my sister, please feed her some meat and give her this salmon roe. I bought my sister 30 jars of salmon roe because she's pregnant again. And I was like, you need phospholipid-derived DHA. Please feed this to
her. Yes.
Please feed this to your daughter. I think it's true. And I love that, man. I think it's so simple. I think that meat and animal products, especially like liver and organs, I mean, those are superfoods.
Yeah.
And I mean, plant foods don't even compare. They're just not even in the same ballpark. And yet nobody's touting beef jerky or like liver jerky as a superfood. When in fact, I suspect you would agree with this. If you walk into any grocery store, that would be the most nutrient dense food in the whole store, hands down.
I mean, absolutely.
And over at least half the people that walk into that grocery store think it's bad for them.
Yeah. That is it. Yeah. I check out and the checker's like, what is this guy buying? Like, I'm always asked, like, are you having a party? I'm like, a party of one, but.
I get the exact same thing here, man. They're like, are you having a barbecue? And I'm like, no. This is like, well, how long is this going to last you? And, you know, I'll walk out with like 40 pounds of meat, you know,
exactly.
30. I'm like, well, maybe a week. And they're like, their eyes get real big and they're just like, oh my God. They're like, well, you look fit. I mean,
it's like working for you.
They have this cognitive dissonance. I mean, you know, as a physician, you know, I'm sure you get this too, but like, you know, I know that somebody, if because they look fit on the outside doesn't mean they're fit on the inside, but they see me and they see you and they're like, these guys look fit. And they're smiling. They're like, how is this even possible? So
it's true. I learned that lesson the hard way. Like, I thought that for a long time, like, look, if someone could build muscle and keep a good body fat, like, they got to be healthy, right? But it's a lot more complicated than
that. It is more complicated than that. But I mean, it sounds like you've done the research on yourself. And did you say that you posted lab work somewhere or blood work about?
Yeah, I posted lab work. I'm writing my blog all the time. I post my lab work up there, which I think is an interesting read for people that are doing this, because my results are my cholesterol is super high. I had a couple other I call outlier values that I discuss in the article. So it's kind of like I advise people to like read it or at least have a heads up. Like if you're going to go get your blood work done, like no, have a basic understanding before you do, or your doctor's going to flip, or you're going to be caught, you know, unexpected. Like you need to have a proper framework, like before getting these tests done.
Where is that? Is that at kevinstock.io?
Yeah. Kevinstock.io. Yeah. Yeah.
I have to check it out just briefly before we wrap up. So we've talked about cholesterol a bunch before, but did your LDL go up high, but your HDL was high and your triglycerides were low, the common pattern?
Yeah. Yeah. So my kind of where I erred was I didn't have blood work done for a long time. You know, I'm a young guy and I've been healthy. It's like, I wasn't super concerned, but I got it because I'd eaten nothing but meat for God knows how long. So I got the blood work done. My LDL was, my total was over 300. My HDL was like 111, like real high. Triglycerides were fine. Like they were low.
How low is low? Do you remember?
I want to say 70. I'd have to look. I mean, I wasn't concerned.
Yeah, fair. I wouldn't be either. And then what other outlier values did you have?
So the one outlier that I'm still going to continue to investigate is ferritin. Mm-hmm. My ferritin was high. And, you know, I got hypotheses on why it might be high. Maybe I have HH, but I have other hypotheses as well. Easy to test for. My GGT was low. So it's like I'm not real concerned, but other people in the comments are concerned for me. Appreciate that, guys. Yeah.
Did you do an iron sat? Did you do a transferrin sat?
No, that's what I need to get. I just haven't. I should just do it to appease everyone. To me, in the article, it's like, and I explain this in the article, like I'm just not concerned about high cholesterol because I read that I'm fairly well versed in cholesterol. I'm not super well versed in ferritin and iron, but I know what it is and I know certain factors, and it's like, it's a little bit high. I'll keep my eye on it, but it's not something I'm going to freak out over right now.
Yeah, I think especially with normal insulin markers, with normal insulin sensitivity, with normal hepatic markers, ASC, ALT, and GGT. So I'll break this down for people just real quickly. So when Kevin says HH, he means hereditary hemochromatosis, which is a genetic condition. It's a mutation in a gene called the HFE gene, which causes extremely avid absorption of iron from the gut. It's fairly uncommon in the population. I think it's like 1 in 100,000. I'm just pulling those numbers out of the air.
Is it? I thought it was more common than that, especially with European ancestry.
Maybe it's 1 in 10,000. I don't know, but it's something like that. It's maybe, I don't know. It's in the ballpark. Okay. I'm just guessing. I could look it up real quickly, so people want to get screened if their ferritin is high and get a full iron panel. Ferritin is the iron storage form. And then you can look at things like transferrin saturation, serum iron. Ultimately, it's a genetic test. 23andMe will tell you if you have the H63D mutation in the HFE gene. Hopefully that's not, I mean, people are like, I'm speaking gibberish right now, but some people might find it interesting. So it's fairly easy to test for. It's just that the way to treat HH, if you have it, I'm certainly don't believe that you do, or we don't have a strong suspicion yet, is just, you know,
therapy.
Phlebotomy. It doesn't mean you can't or you shouldn't eat meat. It just means you should just give blood and save other people's lives. It means you are the best blood factory on the planet.
That's right. I think it's important to note is so ferritin is elevated most commonly secondary to inflammatory response.
Yeah.
And I mean, hsCRP is a very generalized test, but like if I had a serious inflammatory issue, my hsCRP would have been elevated and it was microscopically low. I think it was below the detectable limit. And so it's like, there's strong evidence that I don't have very much inflammation going on. I have elevated ferritin, but a lot of other markers look just fine. Like you said, insulin was like 2.3. So there was just a lot of, in the whole article, I talk about context. And so this is kind of a good example. It's like, you have to understand these numbers in the context of other numbers, but also in the context of your diet and your life and the season. And there's a lot of factors that go into these numbers that, you know, you can't just take a number at face value and just try and manipulate a number for a number's sake. It's much better to try and understand why that number is what it is and, you know, try and make sense of it. And if it needs to be evaluate further, but that's kind of the moral of the story.
I think everyone should be screened. You know, I think everyone, whether you're eating a carnivore diet or not, needs
to. Yeah, it's good to know.
should know what your iron levels are. A lot of people are anemic and they have a low iron. And so
that's far more common.
Yeah. I think a full iron panel is something that I recommend to everyone, which would be a ferritin, a serum iron, a transfer and a transfer and sat.
Yep.
And then you'd know. And I think in your case, you know, how high was your ferritin? Do you remember?
It was in the 500s.
Yeah, I mean, you could check. I mean, you'd know basically by looking at a transferrin sat, you'd know whether you should. And then if people have done 23andMe, which is interesting from the perspective of other genetics and stuff, that would tell you as well regarding any of the iron storage diseases. So yeah, it's pretty cool stuff. I've done a bunch of my labs and talked about them as well. And generally, I've seen the same things, you know, very low inflammatory markers. My hsCRP was also less than 0.3, you know, no changes in kidney function, essentially, you know, stable, you know, normal testosterone, normal levels of sex hormone binding globulin. For me, normal levels of iron, no real abnormalities happen. So, I mean, we wouldn't expect it, right? This is the evolution. This is the way we've eaten, right? This is okay. Yeah. But we're sort of like, just as physicians, we're trying to just prove to ourselves, hey, this is okay. You're not going to get
it. Like, it's interesting.
It is interesting. And it provides conversations like this. So
it does. It can get expensive. That's the only thing. But
in the name of science,
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thanks for talking, my friend. It's been great to connect.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Where can people find you if they want to work with you, if they just want to get shredded, read your stuff or get big or anything else that you can provide for them?
You know what? I would say don't follow me on social, or do if you want to, but I put all my best stuff in a weekly newsletter. I send it out every Saturday morning. And you can just sign up at the website, kevinstock.io. But yeah, my best stuff's in the newsletter. That way, I just wish everyone had a newsletter so I could subscribe to people's newsletters and not have to do the social media thing. But I get it. Social media is good for getting the word out. And I'm on, you know, all the platforms. So.
Okay. And what are you on Instagram? Or
kevinstock12 everywhere.
Everywhere? Okay. Yeah. I'll put it in the show notes and stuff for people.
Yeah.
All right, sir.
Oh, man. Appreciate it.
Enjoy the rest of your day. I'm sure we'll be talking more and sharing all sorts of good data about mouth stuff and
beating. Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely. Man. Thanks, Paul. Have a good one. Bye.
All right, you guys, that is a wrap. Wasn't that a cool conversation? I always wonder how many people actually listen to the outro here and get to hear me kind of wrap it up. But I thought that was really cool. It's so interesting to me that you can gain weight, that you can gain muscle mass on a carnivore diet. And it's probably just a matter of making sure you eat a lot of stuff and give your body the signals that it needs to do so. I think, like I mentioned in the intro, the mouth is an absolute window to the health of the body. And I've always respected dentistry. And it was so cool to have a conversation with Kevin and talk about the ways that he has seen this in practice as well. I think that if we're doing any diet, whether it's plant-based, I hope not, or carnivore or omnivore, we should really look at the health of our mouths to indicate how well this is doing for the inside of our bodies. I noticed that when I went carnivore, the health of my gums improved radically. I had significant gum recession from my days as a vegan, probably even from my days as a carnivore. I also noticed that my teeth feel cleaner. You know those like mittens on your teeth that you get? You can feel the bacteria growing. And when I do carnivore, my teeth feel so much cleaner. They're smooth all day. And I think this is a real interesting idea. If you look at the Hadza and the San and the Ikung in Africa, when they eat a lot of honey, they actually get tooth decay. So it's clear that no matter where the sugar source is from, whether it's natural or fruit or processed candy bar, it's going to be bad for our teeth, and I think we should not be putting acidic things on our teeth either, like acetic acid, lemon juice. I think it will erode the enamel, as we talked about. So I shouldn't make the outro too long, but remember, you guys, I think that animal foods are the most nutrient-dense foods on the planet. I think the more you include of those, the better, and I'm excited for you guys to keep thriving. Check out my newsletter, Fundamental Health Newsletter. My website is paulsaladinomd.com. You can sign up for the newsletter there. And check out Ancestral Supplements, ancestralsupplements.com. Putting back in what the modern world has left out. I really think these guys make a good line of supplements. They are New Zealand grass-fed organ meats. It's hard for people to eat these organs, and I think this is a great way to begin to get these back in your life. I really think if you look at their reviews on Amazon, they are super impressive. Like I said in the intro, I met these guys. They are good people to the core. And I'm so grateful to be associated with them. So, have a good week. I will see you guys in the future.